This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Benjamin Franklin by Walter Isaacson, narrated by Nelson Runger. This book is copyrighted 2003 by Walter Isaacson. This recording is copyrighted 2004 by Recorded Books. Benjamin Franklin was, during his 84-year life, America's best scientist, inventor, diplomat, writer, and business strategist. And he was also one of its most practical, though not most profound, political thinkers. He proved by flying a kite that lightning was electricity, and he invented a rod to tame it. He sought practical ways to make stoves less smoky and commonwealths less corrupt. He organized neighborhood constabularies and international alliances, local lending libraries, and national legislatures. He combined two types of lenses to create bifocals, and two concepts of representation to foster the nation's federal compromise. He was the only man who shaped all the founding documents of America: the Albany Plan of Union, the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty of Alliance with France, the peace treaty with England, and the Constitution. And he helped invent America's unique style of homespun humor, democratic values, and philosophical pragmatism. But ultimately, the most interesting thing that Benjamin Franklin invented and continually reinvented was himself. Here, Walter Isaacson provides the full sweep of Franklin's life and shows how Franklin helped to create the American character and why he has a peculiar resonance today at the outset of the 21st century. And now, Benjamin Franklin.
Chapter 1. Benjamin Franklin and the invention of America. His arrival in Philadelphia is one of the most famous scenes in autobiographical literature. The bedraggled 17-year-old runaway, cheeky yet with a pretense of humility, straggling off the boat and buying three puffy rolls as he wanders up Market Street. But wait a minute. There's something more. Peel back a layer, and we can see him as a 65-year-old wry observer sitting in an English country house, writing this scene, pretending it's part of a letter to his son, an illegitimate son who has become a royal governor with aristocratic pretensions and needs to be reminded of his humble roots. A careful look at the manuscript peels back yet another layer. Inserted into the sentence about his pilgrim's progress up Market Street is a phrase, written in the margin, in which he notes that he passed by the house of his future wife, Deborah Reed, and that she, standing at the door, saw me and thought I made, as I certainly did, a most awkward, ridiculous appearance. So here we have, in a brief paragraph, the multi-layered character known so fondly to his author as Benjamin Franklin. As a young man, then seen through the eyes of his older self, and then through the memories later recounted by his wife. It's all topped off with the old man's deft little affirmation, "as I certainly did," in which his self-deprecation barely cloaks the pride he felt regarding his remarkable rise in the world. Benjamin Franklin is the founding father who winks at us. George Washington's colleagues found it hard to imagine touching the austere general on the shoulder, and we would find it even more so today. Jefferson and Adams are just as intimidating. But Ben Franklin, that ambitious urban entrepreneur, seems made of flesh rather than of marble, addressable by nickname. And he turns to us from history's stage with eyes that twinkle from behind those newfangled spectacles. He speaks to us through his letters and hoaxes and autobiography, not with orotund rhetoric, but with a chattiness and clever irony that is very contemporary, sometimes unnervingly so. We see his reflection in our own time. He was, during his 84-year-long life, America's best scientist, inventor, diplomat, writer, and business strategist. And he was also one of its most practical, though not most profound, political thinkers. He proved by flying a kite that lightning was electricity, and he invented a rod to tame it. He devised bifocal glasses and clean-burning stoves, charts of the Gulf Stream, and theories about the contagious nature of the common cold. He launched various civic improvement schemes, such as a lending library, college, volunteer fire corps, insurance association, and matching grant fundraiser. He helped invent America's unique style of homespun humor and philosophical pragmatism. In foreign policy, he created an approach that wove together idealism with balance of power realism. And in politics, he proposed seminal plans for uniting the colonies and creating a federal model for a national government. But the most interesting thing that Franklin invented and continually reinvented was himself. America's first great publicist, he was, in his life and in his writings, consciously trying to create a new American archetype. In the process, he carefully crafted his own persona, portrayed it in public, and polished it for posterity. Partly, it was a matter of image. As a young printer in Philadelphia, he carted rolls of paper through the streets to give the appearance of being industrious. As an old diplomat in France, he wore a fur cap to portray the role of backwoods sage. In between, he created an image for himself as a simple yet striving tradesman, assiduously honing the virtues, diligence, frugality, honesty, of a good shopkeeper and beneficent member of his community. But the image he created was rooted in reality. Born and bred a member of the leather-aproned class, Franklin was, at least for most of his life, more comfortable with artisans and thinkers than with the established elite. And he was allergic to the pomp and perks of a hereditary aristocracy. Throughout his life, he would refer to himself as B. Franklin, Printer. From these attitudes sprang what may be Franklin's most important vision: an American national identity based on the virtues and values of its middle class. Instinctively more comfortable with democracy than were some of his fellow founders, and devoid of the snobbery that later critics would feel toward his own shopkeeping values, he had faith in the wisdom of the common man, and felt that a new nation would draw its strength from what he called the middling people. Through his self-improvement tips for cultivating personal virtues and his civic improvement schemes for furthering the common good, he helped to create, and to celebrate, a new ruling class of ordinary citizens. The complex interplay among various facets of Franklin's character, his ingenuity and unreflective wisdom, his Protestant ethic divorced from dogma, the principles he held firm and those he was willing to compromise, means that each new look at him reflects and refracts the nation's changing values. He has been vilified in romantic periods and lionized in entrepreneurial ones. Each era appraises him anew, and in doing so, reveals some assessments of itself. Franklin has a particular resonance in 21st century America. A successful publisher and consummate networker with an inventive curiosity, he would have felt right at home in the information revolution. And his unabashed striving to be part of an upwardly mobile meritocracy made him, in social critic David Brooks's phrase, our founding yuppie. We can easily imagine having a beer with him after work, showing him how to use the latest digital device, sharing the business plan for a new venture, and discussing the most recent political scandals or policy ideas. He would laugh at the latest joke about a priest and a rabbi, or about a farmer's daughter. We would admire both his earnestness and his self-aware irony. And we would relate to the way he tried to balance, sometimes uneasily, the pursuit of reputation, wealth, earthly virtues, and spiritual values. Some who see the reflection of Franklin in the world today fret about a shallowness of soul and a spiritual complacency that seem to permeate a culture of materialism. They say that he teaches us how to live a practical and pecuniary life, but not an exalted existence. Others see the same reflection and admire the basic middle-class values and democratic sentiments that now seem under assault from elitists, radicals, reactionaries, and other bashers of the bourgeoisie. They regard Franklin as an exemplar of the personal character and civic virtue that are too often missing in modern America. Much of the admiration is warranted, and so too are some of the qualms. But the lessons from Franklin's life are more complex than those usually drawn by either his fans or his foes. Both sides too often confuse him with the striving pilgrim he portrayed in his autobiography. They mistake his genial moral maxims for the fundamental faiths that motivated his actions. His morality was built on a sincere belief in leading a virtuous life, serving the country he loved, and hoping to achieve salvation through good works. That led him to make the link between private virtue and civic virtue, and to suspect, based on the meager evidence he could muster about God's will, that these earthly virtues were linked to heavenly ones as well. As he put it in the motto for the library he founded, "To pour forth benefits for the common good is divine." In comparison to contemporaries, such as Jonathan Edwards, who believed that men were sinners in the hands of an angry God and that salvation could come through grace alone, this outlook might seem somewhat complacent. In some ways, it was, but it was also genuine. Whatever view one takes, it is useful to engage anew with Franklin, for in doing so, we are grappling with a fundamental issue. How does one live a life that is useful, virtuous, worthy, moral, and spiritually meaningful? For that matter, which of these attributes is most important? These are questions just as vital for a self-satisfied age as they were for a revolutionary one. Chapter 2. Pilgrim's Progress. Boston, 1706 to 1723. The Franklins of Ecton. During the late Middle Ages, a new class emerged in the villages of rural England. Men who possessed property and wealth, but were not members of the titled aristocracy. Proud, but without great pretension, assertive of their rights as members of an independent middle class, These freeholders came to be known as Franklins, from the Middle English word Frankelein, meaning free men. When surnames gained currency, families from the upper classes tended to take on the titles of their domains, such as Lancaster or Salisbury. Their tenants sometimes resorted to invocations of their own little turf, such as hill or meadows. Artisans tended to take their name from their labor, be it smith or tailor or weaver. And for some families, the descriptor that seemed most appropriate was Franklin. The earliest documented use of that name by one of Benjamin Franklin's ancestors, at least that can be found today, was by his great-great-grandfather, Thomas Franklin, or Franklin, born around 1540 in the Northamptonshire village of Acton. His independent spirit became part of the family lore. "This obscure family of ours was early in the Reformation," Franklin later wrote, "and were sometimes in danger of trouble on account of their zeal against popery." When Queen Mary I was engaged in her bloody crusade to re-establish the Roman Catholic Church, Thomas Franklin kept the banned English Bible tied to the underside of a stool. The stool could be turned over on a lap so the Bible could be read aloud, but then instantly hidden whenever the apparitor rode by. The strong yet pragmatic independence of Thomas Franklin, along with his clever ingenuity, seems to have been passed down through four generations. The family produced dissenters and nonconformists who were willing to defy authority, although not to the point of becoming zealots. They were clever craftsmen and inventive blacksmiths with a love of learning. Avid readers and writers, they had deep convictions, but knew how to wear them lightly. Sociable by nature, the Franklins tended to become trusted counselors to their neighbors, and they were proud to be part of the middling class of independent shopkeepers and tradesmen and freeholders. It may be merely a biographer's conceit to think that a person's character can be illuminated by rummaging among his family roots and pointing out the recurring traits that culminate tidally in the personality at hand. Nevertheless, Franklin's family heritage seems a fruitful place to begin a study. For some people, the most important formative element is place. To appreciate Harry Truman, for example, you must understand the Missouri frontier of the 19th century. Likewise, you must delve into the hill country of Texas to fathom Lyndon Johnson. But Benjamin Franklin was not so rooted. His heritage was that of a people without place, the youngest sons of middle-class artisans, most of whom made their careers in towns different from those of their fathers. He is thus best understood as a product of lineage rather than of land. Moreover, Franklin thought so as well. "I have ever had a pleasure in obtaining any little anecdotes of my ancestors," reads the opening sentence in his autobiography. It was a pleasure he would indulge when he journeyed to Acton as a middle-aged man to interview distant relatives, research church records, and copy inscriptions from family tombstones. The dissenting streak that ran in his family, he discovered, involved more than just matters of religion. Thomas Franklin's father had been active, according to lore, as a legal advocate on the side of the common man in the controversy over the practice known as enclosure, under which the landed aristocracy closed off their estates and prevented poorer farmers from grazing their herds there. And Thomas's son Henry spent a year in prison for writing some poetry that, as one descendant noted, touched the character of some great man. The inclination to defy the elite, and to write mediocre poetry, was to last a few more generations. Henry's son, Thomas II, also displayed traits that would later be evident in his famous grandson. He was a gregarious soul who loved reading, writing, and tinkering. As a young man, he built from scratch a clock that worked throughout his life. Like his father and grandfather, he became a blacksmith, but in small English villages, the smith took on a variety of tasks. According to a nephew, he also practiced for diversion the trade of a turner, turning wood with a lathe, a gunsmith, a surgeon, a scrivener, and wrote as pretty a hand as ever I saw. He was a historian and had some skill in astronomy and chemistry. His eldest son took over the blacksmith business and also prospered as a school owner and a solicitor. But this is a story about youngest sons. Benjamin Franklin was the youngest son of the youngest sons for five generations. Being the last of the litter often meant having to strike out on your own. For people like the Franklins, that generally meant leaving villages such as Ecton that were too tiny to support more than one or two practitioners of each trade, and moving to a larger town where they could secure an apprenticeship. It was not unusual, especially in the Franklin family, for younger brothers to be apprenticed to older ones. So it was that Thomas II's youngest son, Josiah Franklin, left Ecton in the 1670s for the nearby Oxfordshire market town of Banbury and bound himself to a pleasant older brother named John, who had set up shop there as a silk and cloth dyer. After the dour days of Cromwell's protectorate, the restoration under King Charles II led to a brief flowering of the garment industry. While in Banbury, Josiah was swept up in the second great religious convulsion to hit England. The first had been settled by Queen Elizabeth. The English church would be Protestant rather than Roman Catholic. Yet she and her successors subsequently faced pressure from those who wanted to go even further and to purify the church of all Roman Catholic traces. The Puritans, as these Calvinist dissenters who advocated this purge of papist vestiges came to be known, were particularly vocal in Northamptonshire and Oxfordshire. They stressed congregational self-governance, emphasized the sermon and Bible study over the liturgy and ritual, and disdained much of the Anglican Church's adornments as lingering pollutants from the Church of Rome. Despite their puritanical views on personal morality, their sect appealed to some of the more intellectual members of the middle class because it emphasized the value of meetings, discussions, sermons, and a personal understanding of the Bible. By the time Josiah arrived in Banbury, the town was torn by the struggle over Puritanism. During one of the more physical battles, a mob of Puritans toppled Banbury's famous cross. The Franklin family was divided as well, though less bitterly. John and Thomas III remained loyal to the Anglican Church. Their younger brothers, Josiah and Benjamin, sometimes called Benjamin the Elder to distinguish him from his famous nephew, became dissenters. But Josiah was never fanatic in pursuing theological disputes. There is no record of any family feud over the issue. Errand into the Wilderness. Franklin would later claim that it was a desire to enjoy the exercise of their religion with freedom that led his father Josiah to emigrate to America. To some extent, this was true. The end of Cromwell's Puritan rule and the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 had led to restrictions on the Puritan faithful, and dissenting ministers were forced from their pulpits. But Josiah's brother, Benjamin the Elder, was probably right in attributing the move more to economic than religious factors. Josiah was not zealous about his faith. He was close to his father and older brother John, both of whom remained Anglican. All evidence suggests that it was a spirit of independence, coupled with a kind of intellectual liveliness and earthy practicality, rather than controlling doctrinal persuasions, that led the only two Franklins, Benjamin the Elder and Josiah, who became Puritans, to follow that course, wrote Arthur Tortelot, author of a comprehensive book about the first 17 years of Franklin's life. Josiah's greater concern was supporting his family. At age 19, he married a friend from Ecton, Anne Child, and brought her to Banbury. In quick succession, they had three children. With his apprenticeship over, he worked on salary in his brother's shop. But there was not enough business to support both fast-growing Franklin families, and the law made it impossible for Josiah to go into a new trade without serving another apprenticeship. As Benjamin the Elder put it, things not succeeding there, according to his mind, with the leave of his friends and father, he went to New England in the year 1683. The story of the Franklin family migration, like the story of Benjamin Franklin, gives a glimpse into the formation of the American character. Among the great romantic myths about America is that, as school books emphasize, the primary motive of its settlers was freedom, particularly religious freedom. Like most romantic American myths, it contains a lot of truth. For many in the 17th century wave of Puritan migration to Massachusetts, as in the subsequent migratory waves that made America, the journey was primarily a religious pilgrimage, one that involved fleeing persecution and pursuing freedom. And like most romantic American myths, it also glosses over some significant realities. For many other Puritan migrants, as for many in subsequent waves, the journey was primarily an economic quest. But to set up such a sharp dichotomy is to misunderstand the Puritans and America. For most Puritans, ranging from rich John Winthrop to poor Josiah Franklin, their errand into the wilderness was propelled by considerations of both faith and finance. The Massachusetts Bay Colony was, after all, established by investors such as Winthrop to be a chartered commercial enterprise, as well as to create a heavenly city upon a hill. These Puritans would not have made an either-or distinction between spiritual and secular motives. For among the useful notions that they bequeathed to America was a Protestant ethic that taught that religious freedom and economic freedom were linked, that enterprise was a virtue, and that financial success need not preclude spiritual salvation. Instead, the Puritans were contemptuous of the old Roman Church's monastic belief that holiness required withdrawal from worldly economic concerns, and they preached that being industrious was a heavenly as well as earthly imperative. What the literary historian Perry Miller calls the paradox of Puritan materialism and immateriality was not paradoxical to the Puritans. Making money was a way to glorify God. As Cotton Mather put it in his famous sermon, A Christian at His Calling, delivered 5 years before Franklin was born, it was important to attend to some settled business wherein a Christian should spend most of his time, so that he may glorify God by doing good for others and getting of good for himself. The Lord, quite conveniently, smiled on those who were diligent in their earthly calling, and, as poor Richard's almanac would later note, helped those who helped themselves. And thus the Puritan migration established the foundation for some characteristics of Benjamin Franklin and of America itself. A belief that spiritual salvation and secular success need not be at odds, that industriousness is next to godliness, and that free thought and free enterprise are integrally related. A man of solid judgment. Josiah Franklin was 25 years old when, in August 1683, he set sail for America with his wife, two toddlers, and a baby girl only a few months old. The voyage, in a squat frigate crammed with 100 passengers, took more than 9 weeks, and it cost the family close to £15, which was about 6 months' earnings for a tradesman such as Josiah. It was, however, a sensible investment. Wages in the New World were 2 to 3 times higher, and the cost of living was lower. The demand for brightly dyed fabrics and silks was not great in a frontier town, especially a Puritan one such as Boston. Indeed, it was a legal offense to wear clothing that was considered too elaborate. But unlike in England, there was no law requiring a person to serve a long apprenticeship before going into a trade. So Josiah chose a new one that had far less glamour, but far more utility, that of a tallow chandler, rendering animal fat into candles and soap. It was a shrewd choice. Candles and soap were just evolving from luxuries into staples. The odoriferous task of making lye from ashes and simmering it for hours with fat was one that even the heartiest of frontier housewives were willing to pay someone else to do. Cattle, once a rarity, were being slaughtered more often, making mass manufacture of tallow possible. Yet the trade was uncrowded. One register of professions in Boston, just before Josiah arrived, lists 12 cobblers, 11 tailors, 3 brewers, but only 1 tallow chandler. He set up shop and residence in a rented 2.5-story clapboard house, only 30 feet by 20, on the corner of Milk Street and High Street, now Washington Street. The ground floor was only 1 room, with a kitchen in a separate tiny structure added in the back. Like other Boston houses, it had small windows so that it would be easier to keep warm, but it was brightly painted to make it seem more cheerful. Across the street was the South Church, newest and most liberal, relatively speaking, of Boston's 3 Puritan congregations. Josiah was admitted to membership, or permitted to own the covenant, 2 years after his arrival. Church membership was, for the Puritans at least, a social leveler. Although he was merely a struggling tradesman, Josiah was able, because of his membership in the South Church, to become friends with such colony luminaries as Simon Bradstreet, the one-time governor, and Judge Samuel Sewall, a Harvard fellow and diligent diarist. A trusted and paternalistic figure, Josiah rose within Boston's Puritan civic hierarchy. In 1697, he was tapped to become a tithing man, the name for the moral marshals whose job it was to enforce attendance and attention at Sunday services and keep an eye out for night walkers, tipplers, Sabbath breakers, or whatever else tending toward debauchery, irreligion, profaneness, and atheism. 6 years later, he was made a constable, one of 11 people who helped oversee the tithing men. Although the posts were unpaid, Josiah practiced the art, which his son would perfect, of marrying public virtue with private profit. He made money by selling candles to the night watchman he oversaw. In his autobiography, Benjamin Franklin gives a lapidary description of his father. "He had an excellent constitution of body, was of middle stature, but well set and very strong. He was ingenious, could draw prettily, was skilled a little in music, and had a clear, pleasing voice, so that when he played psalm tunes on his violin and sang withal, as he sometimes did in an evening after the business of the day was over, it was extremely agreeable to hear. He had a mechanical genius, too, and on occasion was very handy in the use of other tradesmen's tools. But his great excellence lay in a sound understanding and solid judgment in prudential matters, both in private and public affairs. I remember well his being frequently visited by leading people who consulted him for his opinion in affairs of the town or of the church. He was also much consulted by private persons about their affairs when any difficulty occurred, and frequently chosen an arbitrator between contending parties." This description was perhaps overly generous. It is contained, after all, in an autobiography designed in part to instill filial respect in Benjamin's own son. As we shall see, Josiah, wise though he undoubtedly was, had limited horizons. He tended to dampen his son's educational, professional, and even poetic aspirations. Josiah's most prominent trait was captured in a phrase, deeply Puritan in its fealty to both industriousness and egalitarianism, that would be inscribed on his tombstone by his son: "Diligence in thy calling." It came from Josiah's favorite piece of Solomonic wisdom, Proverbs chapter 22, verse 29, a passage that he would quote often to his son: "Seest thou a man diligent in his calling, he shall stand before kings." As Franklin would recall when he was 78, with the wry mixture of light vanity and amused self-awareness that pervades his autobiography, "I from thence considered industry as a means of obtaining wealth and distinction, which encouraged me. Though I did not think that I should ever literally stand before kings, which, however, has since happened, for I have stood before 5, and even had the honor of sitting down with one, the King of Denmark, to dinner." As Josiah prospered, his family grew. He would have 17 children over a period of 34 years. Such fecundity was common among the robust and lusty Puritans. The Reverend Samuel Willard, pastor of the South Church, had 20 children. The famous theologian Cotton Mather had 15. Children tended to be a resource rather than a burden. They helped around the house and shop by handling most of the menial chores. To the 3 children who accompanied them from England, Josiah and Anne Franklin quickly added 2 more, both of whom lived to adulthood: Josiah Jr., born in 1685, and Anne Jr., born in 1687. Then, however, death struck brutally. 3 times over the next 18 months, Josiah made the procession across Milk Street to the South Church burial grounds. First in 1688, for a newborn son who died after 5 days, then in 1689 for his wife Anne, who died a week after delivering another son, then for that son who died after another week. 1/4 of all Boston newborns at the time died within a week. It was not unusual for men in colonial New England to outlive two or three wives. Of the first 18 women who came to Massachusetts in 1628, for example, 14 died within a year. Nor was it considered callous for a bereaved husband to remarry quickly. In fact, as in the case of Josiah, it was often considered an economic necessity. At the age of 31, he had 5 children to raise, a trade to tend, and a shop to keep. He needed a robust new wife, and he needed her quickly. A virtuous woman. Like the Franklins, the Folger, originally Folger spelled F-O-U-L-G-I-E-R, family, was rebellious but also practical. And they shared the same mix of religious and economic restlessness. Descended from reformist Flemish Protestants who had fled to England in the 16th century, the Folgers were among the first wave of emigrants to depart for Massachusetts when Charles I and his Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud, began cracking down on the Puritans. The family of John Folger, including his 18-year-old son Peter, sailed for Boston in 1635, when the town was a mere 5 years old. On the voyage over, Peter met a young servant girl named Mary Morrill, who was indentured to one of the Puritan ministers aboard. After their arrival, Peter was able to buy her freedom for £20 and take her as his wife. Having found religious and personal freedom, the Folgers were restless for economic opportunities. From Boston, they moved to a new settlement up the river called Dedham, then to Watertown, and finally to Nantucket Island, where Peter became the schoolmaster. Most of the inhabitants were Indians, and he learned their language, taught them English, and attempted with great success to convert them to Christianity. Rebellious in nature, he underwent his own conversion and became a Baptist, which meant that the faithful Indians whom he had led to Christianity now had to follow him through a ritual that required total immersion. Displaying the robust resistance to authority that ran in both the Folger and Franklin families, Peter was the sort of rebel destined to transform colonial America. As clerk of the court on Nantucket, he was at one point jailed for disobeying the local magistrate during a struggle between the island's wealthy shareholders and its growing middle class of shopkeepers and artisans. He also wrote a near-seditious pamphlet, in verse, sympathizing with the Indians during what became known as King Philip's War in 1676. The war, he declared, was the result of God's anger at the intolerance of the Puritan ministers in Boston. His passion overpowered his poetic talents. "Let magistrates and ministers consider what they do. Let them repeal those evil laws and break those bonds in two." Later, his grandson, Benjamin Franklin, would pronounce that the poem was written with manly freedom and a pleasing simplicity. Peter and Mary Folger had 10 children, the youngest of whom, Abiah, was born in 1667. When she was 21 and still unmarried, she moved to Boston to live with an older sister and her husband, who were members of the South Church. Although raised as a Baptist, Abiah joined the congregation shortly after her arrival. By July 1689, when the well-respected tallow chandler Josiah Franklin went there to bury his wife, Abiah was a faithful parishioner. Less than 5 months later, on November 25th, 1689, they were married. Both were the youngest children in a large brood. Together, they would live to unusually ripe ages, he to 87, she to 84. And their longevity was among the many traits they would bequeath to their famous youngest son, who himself would live to be 84. He was a pious and prudent man, she a discreet and virtuous woman, Benjamin would later inscribe on their tombstone. Over the next 12 years, Josiah and Abiah Franklin had six children. John, born 1690, Peter, 1692, Mary, 1694, James, 1697, Sarah, 1699, and Ebenezer, 1701. Along with those from Josiah's first marriage, that made 11 children, all still unmarried, crammed into the tiny Milk Street house that also contained the tallow, soap, and candle equipment. It might seem impossible to keep a watchful eye on so large a brood in such circumstances, and the Franklin tale provides tragic evidence that this was so. When he was a toddler of 16 months, Ebenezer drowned in a tub of his father's suds. Later that year, in 1703, the Franklins had another son, but he also died as a child. So, even though their next son, Benjamin, would spend his youth in a house with 10 older siblings, the youngest of them would be 7 years his senior. And he would have two younger sisters, Lydia, born 1708, and Jane, 1712, looking up to him. A Spunky Lad. Benjamin Franklin was born and baptized on the same day, a Sunday, January 17th, 1706. Boston was by then 76 years old, no longer a Puritan outpost, but a thriving commercial center filled with preachers, merchants, seamen, and prostitutes. It had more than 1,000 homes, 1,000 ships registered at its harbor, and 7,000 inhabitants, a figure that was doubling every 20 years. As a kid growing up along the Charles River, Franklin was, he recalled, generally the leader among the boys. One of their favorite gathering places was a salt marsh near the river's mouth, which had become a quagmire due to their constant trampling. Under Franklin's lead, the friends built themselves a wharf with stones intended for the construction of a house nearby. In the evening, when the workmen were gone home, I assembled a number of my playfellows, and we worked diligently like so many emmets, sometimes two or three to a stone, until we brought them all to make our little wharf. The next morning, he and the other culprits were caught and punished. Franklin recounted the tale in his autobiography to illustrate, he said, his father's maxim that nothing was useful which was not honest. Yet, like many of Franklin's attempts at self-deprecation, the anecdote seems less designed to show how bad a boy he was than how good a leader he was. Throughout his life, he took palpable pride in his ability to organize cooperative endeavors and public-spirited projects. Franklin's childhood days, playing along the Charles River, also instilled a lifelong love for swimming. Once he had learned and taught his playmates, he tinkered with ways to make himself go faster. The size of people's hands and feet, he realized, limited how much water they could push, and thus their propelling power. So he made two oval pallets with holes for his thumbs, and, as he explained in a letter to a friend, I also fitted to the soles of my feet a kind of sandals. With these paddles and flippers, he could speed through the water. Kites, as he would later famously show, could also be useful. Sending one aloft, he stripped, waded into a pond, floated on his back, and let it pull him. "Having then engaged another boy to carry my clothes round the pond," he recalled, "I began to cross the pond with my kite, which carried me quite over without the least fatigue, and with the greatest pleasure imaginable." One childhood incident that he did not include in his autobiography, though he would recount it more than 70 years later for the amusement of his friends in Paris, occurred when he encountered a boy blowing a whistle. Enchanted by the device, he gave up all the coins in his pocket for it. His siblings proceeded to ridicule him, saying he had paid 4 times what it was worth. "I cried with vexation," Franklin recalled, "and the reflection gave me more chagrin than the whistle gave me pleasure." Frugality became for him not only a virtue, but also a pleasure. "Industry and frugality," he wrote in describing the theme of Poor Richard's Almanacs, "are the means of procuring wealth and thereby securing virtue." When Benjamin was 6, his family moved from the tiny 2-room house on Milk Street, where 14 children had been raised, to a larger home and shop in the heart of town on Hanover and Union Streets. His mother was 45, and that year, 1712, she gave birth to the last of her children, Jane, who was to become Benjamin's favorite sibling and lifelong correspondent. Josiah Franklin's new house, coupled with the dwindling number of children still living with him, allowed him to entertain interesting guests for dinner. "At his table," Benjamin recalled, "he liked to have as often as he could some sensible friend or neighbor to converse with, and always took care to start some ingenious or useful topic for discourse, which might tend to improve the minds of his children." The conversations were so engrossing, Franklin claims in his autobiography, that he took little or no notice of what was served for dinner. This training instilled in him a perfect inattention to food for the rest of his life, a trait he deemed a great convenience, albeit one that seems belied by the number of recipes of American and French culinary delights among his papers. The new home also allowed the Franklins to accommodate Josiah's brother Benjamin, who emigrated from England in 1715 when he was 65 and his namesake was 9. Like Josiah, the elder Benjamin found the new world inhospitable to his craft of silk dyeing, but unlike Josiah, he did not have the drive to learn a new trade. So he sat around the Franklin house writing bad poetry, including a 124-quatrain autobiography, and a useful family history, attending and transcribing sermons, amusing his nephew, and gradually getting on his brother's nerves. Uncle Benjamin stayed with the Franklins for 4 years, easily outlasting his welcome with his brother, if not with his nephew. Finally, he moved in with his own son, Samuel, a cutler who had also immigrated to Boston. Years later, the younger Benjamin would write to his sister Jane and humorously recount the disputes and misunderstandings that grew between their father and uncle. The lesson his father drew was that visits from distant relatives could not well be short enough for them to part good friends. In Poor Richard's Almanac, Franklin would later put it more pithily: "Fish and guests stink after 3 days." Education. The plan for young Benjamin was to have him study for the ministry. Josiah's 10th son anointed as his tithe to the Lord. Uncle Benjamin was strongly supportive. Among the many benefits of this plan, was that it gave him something to do with his stash of second-hand sermons. For decades, he had scouted out the best preachers and transcribed their words in a neat shorthand of his own device. His nephew later noted with wry amusement that he proposed to give me all his shorthand volumes, I suppose, as a stock to set up with. To prepare him for Harvard, Josiah sent his son at age 8 to Boston Latin School, where Cotton Mather had studied, and his son Samuel was then enrolled. Even though he was among the least privileged students, Franklin excelled in his first year, rising from the middle of the class to the very top, and then was jumped a grade ahead. Despite this success, Josiah abruptly changed his mind about sending him to Harvard. "My father," Franklin wrote, "burdened with a numerous family, was unable without inconvenience to support the expense of a college education." This economic explanation is unsatisfying. The family was well off enough, and there were fewer Franklin children being supported at home, only Benjamin and his two younger sisters, than had been the case for many years. There was no tuition at the Latin school, and as the top of his class, he would easily have won a scholarship to Harvard. Of the 43 students who entered the college when Franklin would have, only 7 were from wealthy families. 10 were sons of tradesmen, and 4 were orphans. The university at that time spent approximately 11% of its budget for financial aid, more than it does today. Most likely, there was another factor. Josiah came to believe, no doubt correctly, that his youngest son was not suited for the clergy. Benjamin was skeptical, puckish, curious, irreverent, the type of person who would get a lifelong chuckle out of his uncle's notion that it would be useful for a new preacher to start his career with a cache of used sermons. Anecdotes about his youthful intellect and impish nature abound, but there are none that show him as pious or faithful. Just the opposite. A tale related by his grandson, but not included in the autobiography, shows Franklin to be cheeky not only about religion, but also about the wordiness in worship that was a hallmark of Puritan faith. Dr. Franklin, when a child, found the long graces used by his father before and after meals very tedious, his grandson reported. One day, after the winter's provisions had been salted, "I think, Father," said Benjamin, "if you were to say grace over the whole cask once for all, it would be a vast saving of time." So Benjamin was enrolled for a year at a writing and arithmetic academy 2 blocks away, run by a mild but businesslike master named George Brownell. Franklin excelled in writing, but failed math, a scholastic deficit he never fully remedied, and that, combined with his lack of academic training in the field, would eventually condemn him to be merely the most ingenious scientist of his era, rather than transcending into the pantheon of truly profound theorists such as Newton. What would have happened if Franklin had, in fact, received a formal academic education and gone to Harvard? Some historians, such as Arthur Tortelot, argued that he would have been stripped of his spontaneity, intuitive literary style, zest, freshness, and the uncluttered-ness of his mind. And, indeed, Harvard has been known to do that and worse to some of its charges. But the evidence that Franklin would have so suffered is weak, and does not do justice either to him or to Harvard. Given his skeptical turn of mind and allergy to authority, It is unlikely that Franklin would have become, as planned, a minister. Of the 39 who were in what would have been his class, fewer than half eventually joined the clergy. His rebellious nature may even have been enhanced rather than repressed. The college administrators were at the time wrestling mightily with the excessive partying, eating, and drinking that was infecting the campus. One aspect of Franklin's genius was the variety of his interests, from science to government to diplomacy to journalism. All of them approached from a very practical rather than theoretical angle. Had he gone to Harvard, this diversity in outlook need not have been lost, for the college under the liberal John Leverett was no longer under the firm control of the Puritan clergy. By the 1720s, it offered famous courses in physics, geography, logic, and ethics, as well as the classics and theology. And a telescope atop Massachusetts Hall made it a center for astronomy. Fortunately, Franklin acquired something that was perhaps just as enlightening as a Harvard education: the training and experiences of a publisher, printer, and newspaper man. Apprentice. At age 10, with but 2 years of schooling, Franklin went to work full-time in his father's candle and soap shop, replacing his older brother John, who had served his term as an apprentice and left to set up his own business in Rhode Island. It was not pleasant work. Skimming rendered tallow from boiling cauldrons of fat was particularly noxious, and cutting wicks and filling molds was quite mindless, and Franklin made clear his distaste for it. More ominously, he expressed his strong inclination for the sea, even though his brother Josiah Jr. had recently been lost to its depths. Fearing that his son would break loose and go to sea, Josiah took him on long walks through Boston to see other craftsmen, so that he could observe my inclination and endeavor to fix it on some trade that would keep me on land. This instilled in Franklin a lifelong appreciation for craftsmen and tradesmen. His passing familiarity with an array of crafts also helped make him an accomplished tinkerer, which served him in good stead as an inventor. Josiah eventually concluded that Benjamin would be best as a cutler, making knives and grinding blades. So he was, at least for a few days, apprenticed to Uncle Benjamin's son Samuel. But Samuel demanded an apprenticeship fee that struck Josiah as unreasonable, especially given the history of both hospitality and aggravation that existed between him and the elder Benjamin. Instead, almost by default rather than design, young Benjamin ended up apprenticed in 1718, at age 12, to his brother James, 21, who had recently returned from training in England to set up as a printer. At first, the willful young Benjamin balked at signing the indenture papers. He was a little older than usual for starting an apprenticeship, and his brother demanded a 9-year term instead of the typical 7 years. Eventually, Benjamin signed on, though he was not destined to stay indentured until he was 21. During his time in London, James saw how Grub Street balladeers would churn out odes and hawk them in the coffee houses. So he promptly put Benjamin to work, not only pushing type, but also producing poetry. With encouragement from his uncle, young Franklin wrote 2 works based on news stories, both dealing with the sea. One about a family killed in a boating accident, and the other about the killing of the pirate known as Blackbeard. They were, as Franklin recalled, wretched stuff, but they sold well, which flattered my vanity. Herman Melville would one day write that Franklin was everything but a poet. His father, no romantic, in fact preferred it that way, and he put an end to Benjamin's versifying. My father discouraged me by ridiculing my performances and telling me verse-makers were generally beggars, so I escaped being a poet, most probably a very bad one. When Franklin began his apprenticeship, Boston had only one newspaper, the Boston News Letter, which had been launched in 1704 by a successful printer named John Campbell, who was also the town's postmaster. Then, as today, there was an advantage in the media business to controlling both content and distribution. Campbell was able to join forces with a network of fellow postmasters running from New Hampshire to Virginia. His books and papers were sent along the route for free, unlike those of other printers, and the postmasters in his network would send him a steady stream of news items. In addition, because he held an official position, he could proclaim that his paper was published by authority, an important certification at a time when the press did not pride itself on independence. The link between being the postmaster and a newspaper publisher was so natural that when Campbell lost the former job, his successor as postmaster, William Brooker, assumed that he would also take over the newspaper. Campbell, however, kept hold of it, which prompted Brooker to launch, in December 1719, a rival, the Boston Gazette. He hired James Franklin, the cheapest of the town's printers, to produce it for him. But after 2 years, James lost the contract to print the Gazette, and he did something quite audacious. He launched what was then the only truly independent newspaper in the colonies and the first with literary aspirations. His weekly New England Courant would very explicitly not be published by authority.